Bonjour, les invités distingués, honorable Monsieur Alain Terrien, Madame Margaret Gillam, Monsieur Jean Labelle, Monsieur Mark Weinstein, Mesdames et Messieurs. Je suis très ravi de vous accueillir ici à l'Université McGill pour la 5e conférence de la sécurité d'alimentation. C'est un honneur pour nous à l'Université McGill d'organiser cette conférence sur un sujet de tellement grande importance mondiale. Les présidents et les premiers ministres des pays G8 et G20 ont reconnu la problématique et les défis de nourrir les gens souffrant de la faim, les maladies et la malnutrition. Les leaders des pays G8 ont fait la sécurité d'alimentation une priorité et ils ont établi le fonds d'aider et supporter les pays en Afrique, Asie et Amérique centrale avec le programme de développement des programmes de l'agriculture. Le sujet de la sécurité d'alimentation est définitivement une priorité pour la faculté de l'agriculture et sciences environnementales à l'Université McGill. La faculté a créé un institut dédié à rechercher les solutions et les problèmes de la faim, la malnutrition et les impacts des changements du climat, les effets des gaz à serre, la production de biocarburants et la rareté de l'eau sur la production agricole. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to welcome you this evening to the fifth McGill Conference on Global Food Security. And I'm also pleased to introduce to you this evening the newly appointed director of the McGill Institute of Global Food Security, Dr. Hugo Melgar Quinones. Please, Hugo. The Institute is extremely grateful to IDRC, International Development Research Center of Canada, to the Canadian International Development Agency, CEDA, various foundations, and of course, our very generous alumni who support our various work programs in food security. This evening, we will have the pleasure to recognize a very special member of the McGill community who is very concerned about the global problems of food insecurity, hunger, and malnutrition, and has joined forces with us as we seek solutions to these problems. This year's conference follows four previous annual conferences, which have all been enormously successful. The first conference, held in 2008, was conceived at a time when the world was being shaken by sudden, very high food prices. It was a phenomenon not witnessed in our recent history. We were struck in awe by the food riots in Asia, the Middle East, and parts of Africa. Nobody predicted such wild increases in food riots in Asia, the Middle East, and parts of Africa would have caused social, political, and economic turmoil. The theme of the 2008 conference was therefore aptly titled The World Food Crisis, Framing a McGill Response. With the success of the 2008 conference, we were urged by conference participants to hold a conference the following year, which we did. The theme of the 2009 conference was Impacts of Global Financial Turmoil on Food Security. Just when we thought we were finished and we wanted to pack it in, we were asked by many to continue with this event and to make it a permanent conference. One of the major drivers for this request and the decision to continue was the fact that the food crisis was just not going away. Successive conference themes were, in 2010, food security, water scarcity, and nutrition. In 2011, risks and threats to food security. And the theme of this year's conference is risks and threats to food security. there were some recurring messages which came out from our previous conferences. And these included the lower level of investment in agricultural research, leading to lower growth and productivity in commodity production, subsidized and mandated biofuels programs in the United States and the European Union were leading to greater use of corn and vegetable oil for biofuels, thereby increasing the prices of these commodities. Growing food demand and dietary transition to more animal protein in developing countries, particularly in India and China, resulted in global consumption increasing faster than production. World food prices fell in 2009, but those prices remained well above long-term norms and have started to climb again. The food crisis has not disappeared. Water scarcity and drought, particularly in the semi-arid tropics of Asia and sub-Saharan Africa, will severely impact food availability and contribute to further hunger and malnutrition among some 800 million people of the world's poorest inhabitants. Nutrition interventions are critical to achieving food security, and this factor has so far been largely ignored in the food security debate. Droughts and floods in major food-producing regions of the world were reducing global food stocks and driving up commodity prices. Food safety was identified as a risk to food security, particularly in developing countries. Stringent international food safety regulations, market standards, and trade agreements could actually deny some countries and agricultural producers access to markets ultimately. And several of our conferences pointed to the fact that rising food price volatility often leads to instability in some regions of the world. And this last message is the key reason why there's a focus on price volatility at this year's conference. As in the past, we're always very fortunate to have a large number of invited speakers who accept the invitation to participate in our conferences. And this year is no different. We have some 25 international experts working in various aspects of food security who have agreed to speak at this year's conference. We're very excited about the program, and we thank everyone for their support of the work of the McGill Institute of Global Food Security and our conferences in particular. This year's conference is particularly pertinent in light of the fact that we will be celebrating World Food Day tomorrow. And this year's conference has as the theme, Agricultural Cooperatives, Key to Feeding the World. And we hope that the deliberations of this year's conference will address the topic of how we can use various groups of smallholders, stakeholders and farmers, and cooperatives to help address the issues of feeding the world. Mesdames et messieurs, c'est un plaisir pour moi de vous introduire l'honorable Monsieur Alain Terrien. Monsieur Terrien est l'adjoint parlementaire au ministère des Relations internationales, de la Francophonie et du commerce extérieur du gouvernement du Québec. Monsieur Terrien est un titulaire de baccalauréat et une maîtrise en sciences économiques à UQAM. Durant ses études, il s'est spécialisé dans le commerce extérieur et une analyse des politiques économiques gouvernementales. M. Terrien a enseigné au niveau collégial au Cégep. Depuis 2003, M. Terrien a enseigné à titre le chargé des cours en économie à l'Université de Québec à Montréal, ainsi qu'au HEC Montréal. En 2007, il a publié un ouvrage au sujet des relations économiques fédérales-provinciales. Depuis d'être député de Saint-Guinée, depuis le 4 septembre dernier, M. Thérien a été nommé adjoint parlementaire au ministère des Relations internationales, de la francophonie et du commerce extérieur du gouvernement du Québec et le 20 septembre 2012, il a été élu à l'Assemblée nationale. M. Thérien, s'il vous plaît.
Merci, M. Madra Moutou. Alors, bonsoir à tous. Le ministre étant actuellement en mission à l'étranger, c'est à moi que revient l'honneur d'être ici avec vous. Le ministère est fier de s'associer à l'Université McGill et à cette conférence portant sur la sécurité alimentaire. Nous espérons qu'à travers de multiples et riches débats, nous en arriverons à une vision plus claire des grands défis et des opportunités qui contribuent à améliorer la sécurité alimentaire. L'insuffisance alimentaire se manifeste actuellement autant par une production qui ne semble pas capable de combler la demande que par un profond déséquilibre de la ration alimentaire, autant en quantité qu'en qualité. C'est un problème complexe, n'ayant ni une cause unique, ni une solution simple. Dans mon intervention d'aujourd'hui, je vais soulever trois causes qui représentent une entrave à nourrir durablement une population mondiale en pleine croissance. Première cause, l'ouverture des frontières. Le nouvel ordre mondial créé à la fin de la Seconde Guerre mondiale s'est, entre autres, manifesté par une ouverture prononcée des frontières. Selon les théories économiques, le commerce international amène une productivité accrue, une baisse des coûts de production, ainsi qu'une amélioration de la qualité des produits. Conforté par ces justifications, on a vu naître tour à tour le GATT, le FMI et, à partir de 1958, des ententes régionales qui se sont multipliées. Les conséquences prévisibles de cette marche vers la mondialisation des marchés a été une spécialisation de la production qui a amené une dépendance accrue des consommateurs locaux face aux producteurs étrangers. Dans le domaine qui vous intéresse, au niveau de l'agriculture, cela se manifeste par une diminution de la production locale ainsi qu'une plus grande fragilité des consommateurs face aux fluctuations des prix mondiaux. La deuxième cause, la pression à la hausse des prix mondiaux. La hausse récente du prix du pétrole a entraîné un accroissement de la recherche de substituts à ce produit. Parmi ceux-ci, les agrocarburants se sont de plus en plus manifestés comme étant une solution intéressante. La conséquence de cet engouement n'a pas tardé. Le prix des aliments appliqués a fortement augmenté. À cela, il faut ajouter des modifications dans les habitudes alimentaires des pays émergents. Il n'est donc pas étonnant de constater qu'il y a une plus grande volatilité des prix au cours des 5 dernières années qu'au cours des 2 dernières décennies. Finalement, le réchauffement climatique. Le réchauffement de la planète augmente la fréquence des événements climatiques extrêmes qui affectent les récoltes. Il limite le débit des fleuves déjà surexploités qui traversent des pays à forte démographie et aggrave les tensions politiques. De plus, le réchauffement climatique causera à long terme une diminution marquée du volume des terres cultivables. Les solutions pour atteindre la sécurité alimentaire sont nombreuses. Plusieurs intervenants peuvent jouer un rôle actif et faire partie de cette solution. Étant membre du nouveau gouvernement québécois, je vais insister sur le rôle que peut jouer l'État pour contrer cette menace qui met en péril la survie de l'humanité. D'abord, favoriser les agriculteurs locaux. Sans faire du protectionnisme systématique, le gouvernement doit tenir compte des différents problèmes que vivent les agriculteurs. Les gouvernements travaillent en ce sens. En effet, le domaine de l'agriculture est actuellement le plus encadré du commerce international. Afin de favoriser ce secteur économique, le gouvernement doit créer des conditions pour favoriser les investissements et l'innovation dans ce domaine. Plus précisément, il doit jouer un rôle central dans l'implantation des stratégies agricoles, l'investissement dans les infrastructures et le capital humain, et finalement la gestion des risques à un niveau national et local. Ensuite, il faut encourager l'utilisation des énergies renouvelables. Afin de diminuer l'utilisation des agrocarburants, le gouvernement doit insister sur le développement des énergies renouvelables. Au lieu d'alimenter nos voitures, ces produits doivent alimenter une population menacée. Notre gouvernement s'est clairement engagé en ce sens. L'hydroélectricité, la construction d'éoliennes, la géothermie et l'énergie solaire retiennent d'ailleurs notre attention. Aussi, il faut lutter contre le changement climatique. Pour lutter contre les changements climatiques, les gouvernements doivent avoir des politiques concrètes de réduction des gaz à effet de serre. Le gouvernement auquel j'appartiens entend atteindre une réduction des gaz à effet de serre de 25 % d'ici 2020 par rapport à 1990, ce qui implique, nous en sommes conscients, des choix politiques difficiles. Dans ce cas, l'action du gouvernement, même le plus motivé, ne peut changer la donne de façon significative contre ce problème planétaire. On en convient. C'est pour cela que des ententes internationales doivent être signées et respectées. Historiquement, le Québec a toujours fait sa part dans ce dossier et continuera d'être un chef de file canadien et mondial en ce sens. Finalement, favoriser la production agricole en Afrique. On constate actuellement une hausse de la productivité des terres agricoles en Amérique du Sud, surtout au Brésil et dans l'ancien bloc soviétique. Par contre, ces gains de production seront insuffisants pour combler la croissance de la demande dans les pays émergents. Il faut donc faire appel à un nouveau producteur, et là, on parle de l'Afrique. Pour que ce continent réalise une véritable révolution agricole, les gouvernements étrangers doivent les assister dans ce parcours. À ce sujet, notre ministre, M. Jean-François Lisée, mentionnait que nous voulions accompagner le décollage économique africain pour notre plus grand bien et, évidemment, pour le leur. En conclusion, se nourrir est le besoin le plus important qui soit. Derrière l'opulence et le gaspillage des uns, se cache une large population affamée qui attend des actions concrètes des décideurs de notre monde. Chers invités, vous faites partie de la solution à ce problème titanesque. Cette conférence représente évidemment un pas dans la bonne direction. Comprendre la complexité du défi de la sécurité alimentaire, c'est comprendre l'urgence d'agir. Je vous remercie.
Merci beaucoup, Monsieur Therrien. J'apprécie vos commentaires et je remarque les priorités, les projets, les sujets de sécurité d'alimentation, c'est la même priorité de notre institut à McGill. Donc, nous sommes très contents de travailler avec votre gouvernement et aussi le ministère des Relations internationales. Merci beaucoup encore. Et aussi, je prends cette occasion de remercier le ministre et le ministère des Relations internationales pour leur support de cette conférence et aussi nous avons obtenu avant les subventions des ministères des Relations internationales pour les autres conférences à l'Université McGill sur le sujet des sécurité de l'alimentation mondiale. It is now my pleasure to introduce Mr. Mark Weinstein, the Vice Principal of Development and Alumni Relations at McGill. Mark is a McGill law graduate who has led various fundraising campaigns for the McGill University Health Center, and he is currently responsible for the enormous success of McGill's present capital campaign. Mark has been a tireless worker and supporter on behalf of the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences for our campaign priorities, particularly in helping us to garner additional support for our work in food safety and food security programs. Mark.
Thank you, Dean Madramutu, Monsieur Therrien, Dr. Labelle, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me great pleasure to introduce a McGill alumnae, a great lady who is an accomplished businesswoman and a most generous donor to the Faculty of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences. Margaret, or as we know her, Maggie Gilliam, is a graduate of McGill's Faculty of Science. Though born in Ottawa, she grew up on a farm in Saskatchewan, where she gained an appreciation for agriculture and the importance of sustainability. Madame Gilliam vit maintenant à New York, où elle a passé plus de 30 ans comme analyste de Wall Street, couvrant toutes les facettes de l'industrie de la vente au détail et d'autres domaines connexes. Madame Gilliam est la fondatrice de Gilliam & Co., une firme de recherche et de conseil qui accompagne les entreprises dans l'élaboration et l'exécution de stratégies commerciales viables et permet aux investisseurs d'optimiser les rendements dans les secteurs privés et publics. I am delighted to announce tonight that earlier this year, our Maggie made a transformative gift of $1.5 million to the area of food security. Her gift will support research, teaching, and graduate fellowships at the McGill Institute for Global Food Security right here in the, well, not here, but at Mac Campus in the Faculty of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences. Most notably and in detail, her gift will allow us to establish three items. First, the Margaret A. Gilliam Faculty Scholar in Food Security, held by Dr. Hugo Melgar Quinones, the first director of the Institute for Global Food Security, who's here with us tonight. Second, the Margaret A. Gilliam Fellowships in Food Security to recognize and support outstanding McGill graduate students who are studying global food security issues. Congratulations to the first recipient, Mr. Ramesh Murugasian, who's also here with us tonight, I believe. And third, we have established the Margaret A. Gilliam Endowment in Food Security, which will be used to fund in perpetuity teaching, research, and outreach initiatives related to food security. I couldn't find a better evening to celebrate this than tonight with this great conference. We are tremendously grateful to Maggie Gilliam for her vision, her incredible passion, and her significant commitment to her alma mater, and to her conviction that it is here at McGill that research and scholarship may one day yield the answers we seek to the challenges we face in the area of food security. Grâce à Madame Gilliam et à d'autres donateurs généreux qui reconnaissent le mérite de l'Université McGill, nous pouvons continuer à soutenir nos étudiants qui sont parmi les plus brillants au monde, ainsi que la recherche de pointe menée par des professeurs de calibre mondial. These past 5 years and more, we have reached out to our McGill alumni and friends more actively than ever before, and they have rallied to the cause of our great institution. Thank you, Maggie, for your exemplary support to our students and faculty. Your gift ensures that McGill remains one of the world's great research-intensive and student-centered universities. You have been a long-standing friend, alumni, and fabulous supporter to our great institution. We are forever grateful for your significant commitment, and as we say in Quebec, mille merci. And so without further ado, please welcome Maggie Gilliam.
Well, thank you very much. It was a very nice introduction, and I'm so delighted to see that this conference is attracting such distinguished speakers and such interested people. You know, I just have to make one correction, though. I grew up in British Columbia, not Saskatchewan. But one of the questions I get repeatedly is, why McGill? Why food security? And how could somebody who lives in New York City for the last 50 or so years be interested in food security? Well, I'm really a frustrated farmer. I originally come from Ottawa, as Mark mentioned, and my mother came from Montreal, and I had an aunt who was much, much younger than my mother, she was closer to me in age, who'd come to McGill when I was at a very formative age, like about 7 or 8, and I decided I wanted to come to McGill. And somewhere along the way, my parents decided they would be dropouts in the 40s, you know, before it became fashionable, about 20 years later. And they decided they were going to try farming out in British Columbia. Well, it didn't work out all that wonderfully well. And I decided, well, if I were ever going to go to McGill, I'd better figure out a way to pay for it myself. And so I started a little business. We had a sheep farm. And when you have a sheep farm, you always have leftover lambs. And the easiest way to raise lambs is to just give them to a goat to adopt. And so my brother and I decided we were going to go in the goat business. And we bought a couple of goats, and they sort of multiplied. And we discovered very quickly, and we read up on the subject quite a bit, and we learned that you could do all kinds of wonderful things with goat milk. But one of the things that I latched onto, apart from raising lambs, was that there was a local dairy farmer who was very early in selling raw milk. And I mean, it was super clean and super wonderful, and he got a nice premium price for the milk that he sold. And he got such a high premium, he couldn't afford to raise his bull calves for veal. And so he sold them to me when they were a day old for $1 a piece. And we raised them, my brother and me. My brother dropped out pretty early, though, as a matter of fact. He got more interested in other things. But I was very taken with the goats. And in any event, every year we would raise lambs, and that was sort of how I paid the rent to my father, who ran the farm. And then I bought these little young bull calves. And I'd raise them until they're about 10 months old. They were raised on goat milk, and they were grass-fed. And then I sold them all for $100 a piece. That was a pretty good return on investment, you know. And I did that from about age 13 to about age 17, when I'd saved up enough money to pay for tuition to go to McGill. And at that point, I couldn't pay for the room and board. I didn't have any money. Well, fortunately, my grandmother in Ottawa came to the rescue, and she paid for my room and board. And so next thing I knew, I transferred. I'd gone to Victoria University. It was then a Victoria College. And I moved off to McGill. Well, not long thereafter, my family sold the farm, because, you know, in a family farm, you don't succeed without a lot of child labor. And and I left the fold. But in any event, I was very interested in agriculture back then. And I quickly discovered that if you were going to really be a farmer, as I wanted to be, you had to be rich. You had to own a lot of land and things like that. And that was not going to be in the cards. So I figured I'd better get rich somehow. And so somewhere along the line, I decided I'd go to Wall Street. Back then, it wasn't very feasible for women to get jobs here in Montreal. And I went to the what was now the Harvard Radcliffe Business Program, which was a one-year program that recruited women from McGill and other schools to go and do what was the equivalent of the first year of the Harvard Business School. A couple of years after I was there, it was actually merged into the Harvard Business School so that women could go into the full MBA program. But that was not the case then. And anyway, by a sheer fluke, I wound up at Goldman Sachs and for a field work stint, and they liked me, and I liked them, so I went to work there, and I've been in New York ever since. However, I had not lost my interest in food and agriculture, and I, over the years, became even more interested in the subject of food security and water and safety and all those other things that are of such grave concern to many of us, and in many countries. It's not just... It's everywhere in the world that you have problems along these lines. And I've done a lot of work over the years with Walmart, which is very actively engaged in this sort of thing in many countries of the world. You know, they're in China and India and Argentina and Brazil and Chile and Mexico and Central America. And so they're involved in this sort of thing many, many places. They piqued my interest even more, and then I learned more about what was going on here at the McDonald campus, and I had wanted to make a contribution to McGill in conjunction with the big campaign that Mark's been working on for the last few years, and as a result, this particular endeavor appealed to me, and I always like to invest in people rather than buildings, and so I wanted to do fellowships and that type of thing. So here I am, and That's how I got here, and I'm really delighted to be here, and I hope that my contribution makes a difference. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Maggie, for those words. And I'm sure some of our young students who are in the room today will take heart from what you've said and the inspiration that you've given them to see that there is life after university and a good life after university as well. We had a faculty advisory board meeting last Friday, and one of the members of our faculty advisory board was questioning the value of a university education because he had a few granddaughters, I guess, who could not find gainful employment. But I guess the secret, Ron, which we should say to him, is that if he bought a few goats and sheep and so on, then he might actually do better. His granddaughters might do better. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce to you tonight a gentleman who is no stranger to McGill University and no stranger to our global food security conferences. He has been with us ever since our first conference, and his name is Dr. Jean Labelle. Dr. Labelle is the Vice President of Programs and the Partnership Branch of the International Development Research Center in Ottawa. He has had a long experience working in food security, agriculture, and the environment, and he has contributed in many ways to IDRC's current programs and priorities in food security research, and he has been one of the architects of the Canadian International Food Security Research Fund, to which our universities in Canada have benefited, and we're particularly grateful, Jean, to you and your colleagues in IDRC and CEDA for the foresight that you had in development of this program. I should mention that when IDRC first launched this program a few years ago, that they asked for letters of intent, and I gather internally you thought you would get maybe 40 or 50 letters of intent, make your life relatively easy. You could select 10 projects very easily, but I think you got something closer to 260 or so letters of intent, and that just shows, ladies and gentlemen, the tremendous interest by the universities and by professors all across Canada to launch into research programs in food security. So I think your success can certainly be measured by the amount of interest that professors and students have had in this program. Jean is an environmental specialist by training. He has contributed extensively to the development of ecosystem approaches to human health. He earned his master's degree in occupational health sciences and a graduate diploma in industrial hygiene from McGill. He also has a PhD in environmental sciences from the Université de Québec à Montréal. Donc, il a la même sorte de formation comme notre invité distingué, Monsieur Thérien. Mark has worked extensively with various foundations in his work in IDRC, in with the Syngenta Foundation, Ford, Rockefeller Foundations, in helping to promote work in global food security. So, Jean, it's a pleasure to have you with us again and to be the keynote speaker tonight. And his speech is going to be on price volatility. What goes up must come down. So, Jean, please.
Doing the testing right now that you should have done before. Okay, here it is. Well, thank you very much, Dean Madramutu, Chandra, if I may, for those very kind words of introduction. Madam Gilliam, thank you very much for your generous donation to the Food Security Institute that Chandra and his colleague have played an active and leadership role in creating it, McGill. That, I think, is a good thing. That, I think, is something that is not only good for McGill, but it's good also for the country altogether. And the many researchers and stakeholders that have a stake in food security issues. Monsieur Weinstein, merci aussi d'être ici. Et merci aussi à McGill de m'avoir accueilli durant quelques années, dans les années 80. Et ça fait cette semaine ou la semaine prochaine, ça va faire 25 ans que j'ai gradué de McGill. J'en garde de très bons souvenirs académiques, mais également sociaux. Et jamais je n'aurais cru que 25 ans plus tard, je serais invité à vous donner quelques idées, quelques propos sur la question de la sécurité alimentaire. Et M. Therrien, merci également d'être présent ici ce soir au nom du gouvernement du Québec, qui joue un rôle actif quand vient le temps de parler des questions agricoles ici au Québec, mais ailleurs dans le monde. So, ladies and gentlemen, as I was mentioning, I started, you know, studying at McGill 25 years ago, and at that time I was coming from a biology program specialized in ecology. And for some obscure reason, I decided to do ecology of human in the workplace. So I got a graduate diploma in industrial hygiene, then a master in occupational health, and I ended up working in the chemical industry for some years, looking at occupational health and safety issues, but evolving rapidly towards environmental concern. Through a very obscure path, I ended up doing my PhD in the Amazon through a joint program between a university in Brazil and the University of Quebec in Montreal. And at that time, I was working on the consumption of fish contaminated by mercury that was arising from leaching of the soil in the Amazonian basin, being absorbed by fishes, consumed by humans, and then creating neurobehavioral outcomes that were before clinical science developed on the visual systems and on the motor function of human being in those situations of consuming high quantity of food that were contaminated with mercury. Nothing close to price volatility. And when I received the invitation from Dean Madramotu, I said yes. And then I received another message with the paragraph stating that I should be speaking about price volatility. And I said to myself, why did I say yes to this? I'm still asking myself this question, so maybe afterward I'll figure out if it has been doing that too bad over here. But the question of price volatility came to me through my career at IDRC, where I've been for 15 years, as Chandra was mentioning. And in that context, I had the opportunity of having wonderful colleagues at IDRC, but also colleagues outside of IDRC in the Consultative Group on International Agricultural Research that has provided me with a lot of support, knowledge, that I will be using tonight to bring you a little bit more up to speed of what are the problems with the spike in food price and what are the impacts on food security. I have to make another warning before I start. I'm a French Canadian, you have already heard that. And as a French Canadian, I realized about a year ago that my English was really getting on the wrong side. I cannot pronounce H. So I've been measuring mercury in hair in the Amazon. Hair, not hair. So you might notice that. I have difficulty also with thank you. As a good French Canadian, I say thank you. Now, there's numbers of pronunciation like this that you will notice. There's the one that you will not notice, like the S's, because in French, they are not pronounced. Sometimes I forget them in English. And why I'm saying this, because in the last couple of years, I started to realize that people in the audience look at me strangely. And I'm asking myself, why are they looking at me so strangely? You know, I'm saying things that are important. Well, you know, I think it has to revolve around the grammar. Now, the good news is I've recruited a specialist that I've started working with about 6 weeks ago. I said, I'm going to McGill, you know, I'm going to correct those deficiencies. Well, bad news. This teacher has taught me that for 50 years I've been doing errors, and it's going to be taking a lot of hard work from me in order to correct. So please bear with me that my English is not perfect, and if there is H's, CH's that are not pronounced well, or there is S that are missed, it's not necessarily my fault, but it's 25 years of bad pronunciation of English. Now, let's get into the topics with all these proviso: food security, price volatility, and with the thought provocative title, what goes up must come down. Everyone has probably seen the food security definition that the FAO came with at the time of the World Food Summit in 1996. Food security exists when all people at all times have physical and economic access to sufficient, safe, and nutritious food, and this is to meet their dietary needs and food preferences for an active and healthy life. Fortunately, this food security comes with four dimensions, four pillars. The first one is the availability. Is the food available? Are we producing enough? It's the physical aspect of the food production. The second, the access. It's okay to produce the food, but what about accessing it? What about using it? Which is another dimension. Accessing it means that it's produced, it's being made available in the market, it's being distributed. It means that you can have access to it in good quantity in order to feed yourself. The uses mean that it's not only about producing, it's not only about the distribution, the value chains as we are hearing often. It's also about the quality of the food. About, you know, having nutritious food that is made available to you. And the last access that wrapped the three previous is the stability access. And within the stability, it's the capacity that is present in order to absorb shock. And in food science, in agriculture, we all know that there is variation in time, that there is changing condition, and that what we will be looking a little bit to through the price volatility and the variation of price lenses. Now, price volatility. Again, bear in mind, I am not an expert on food price volatility. I am not an economist either, and I know there's many economists in this room. I am not also an agronomist, remember that. So you may ask yourself, how come you got here? So that's a good question. Well, let's keep this for the question, period. But, you know, bear in mind that if I say something foolish, expert will say, well, he doesn't know what he's speaking about. Of course, he's not an expert. And if I say something brilliant, you know, someone will say, well, of course he has such great staff. So what I can say about this is I'm in a lose-lose situation. You know, everyone talk of win-win, I'm in a lose-lose. So let's try to make the loss a little bit less through the talk. More seriously, when we talk about price volatility, many definitions exist, but for the sake of simplicity, I've put one that is very simple up here. It's a measure of how much and how quickly prices move up or down. Prices, as you know, may move a lot in the short term, across the year, on local markets. This is a known variation. This is something that is, to a certain extent, predictable. Let's use an example that you're familiar with. Tomatoes and cucumbers. You know very well that you're going to pay less for those foods in August on the local market, at Atwater Market or Châtelon Market, then you will pay in the grocery store in January, simply because, you know, there's a local supply that is feeding the market. Let's leave the taste aside. Same apply in international trade staple crops. whether it is the price of wheat or maize or rice. We see higher prices at the beginning of the planting season compared to the time, to the price at the time of the harvesting. So the increase in supply, as you all know, will put pressure on the price to go down. Now, when there is price peaks, customer needs to pay more. Challenges arise when these customers, like the poor and developing region, do not have the resources to pay. And what is muddying the picture is the unpredictable nature of changes. Explaining price movements in any short time period takes in-depth knowledge of the particulars of the case. But for the sake of the presentation here, I've brought some illustration of some challenges that we are facing when trying to interpret the future from the past when it comes to price volatility. Four graphics. I'm giving you a warning. The first one is one that I've used in 2008. 2008, remember, 2007, 2008, a first large spike on commodity related to oil at that time. Oil increase. The price of oil going up, the price of the full line is rice, reaching a world record of $1,000 per ton. Then you have wheat that follows similar path. Maize, a little bit less. And at that time, in between those years, we were looking at these graphics that were published by FAO, that were used by F3, that were used like people like me. And we were saying, what is driving this? Well, you know, the price of oil is going up. Therefore, you know, it costs more to go to the field with the tractor. It may cost more in order to pump the water. The transportation of the food may be more costly because the oil is going up, the price of petroleum. Fertilizer might be going up because of the oil price going up. But there was also a discussion that started to materialize about, yes, but what about, you know, the diversion of these crops towards other use than food, biofuels, for example. And then there was this discussion on the trade. You know, why do we have trade policy where we're closing border to the export in country where we can produce a lot of commodity and having a domino impact on others that don't have access to the food and putting pressure on the price up? The danger with these graphic is that they are at a point in time analysis. If you would have been doing the same interpretation in 2009, you would have had a totally different picture. The price of rice, yes, spiked at that moment, but it went down, and it went down significantly. It goes up, it comes down. Now, it didn't come as low as it was before it increased, but since then, you know, there is fluctuation. There is variability over here. There is some volatility. But, you know, it's not that clear that rice is going back up. What was the rationale? I don't know. Another example that is often used is the food price index that is developed by the FAO, the Food and Alimentation Organization, Agriculture Organization, sorry. Now, the FAO index is a composite index that takes into consideration the price of cereal, dairy, oil, meats, and sugar. If you look at it, so it's integrating multiple perspectives of the prices. If you look at it from 90 to 07, 08, relatively stable, whoop, the 2008 peak, down, whoop, back up in 09, 10. Wheat was
often mentioned as the driver of the year because of the drought. When it's price, I don't know how to pronounce that. Drought.
Yeah, sorry. I know I was not making an error. Drought, and you know, putting pressure because there's a lack of supply.
And this is where we were recently, and it seems to be maize that is driving this. But you know, in 2012, you know, we're going a little bit back down.
It's going up, it's going down. Still, you know, what are the drivers? Many have different interpretation.
The last graphic I want to show you is this one also with the FAO index. But what we do here is that we look at time starting in the 60s, 1960 in fact, down to 2010. What would be the interpretation over here? Well, you know, apart from this spike here that relates to the oil boom, you know, the oil crisis of 72, 73, price seems to be having gone down quite importantly. Why? Well, essentially, you know, performance of agriculture has increased. Now, here, what's going up? Is it going up? Is it going down? Where are we going to be in the future? I don't know. What can we draw from these four graphics is important. I think experts can explain in detail and often with a lot of certainty what caused past commodity price movements. If those experts only had time machines and could go back in time, they could make themselves rich. It's easy to look at the past, it's far more difficult to look at the future. Experts can analyze the causes of currently unfolding price movement with a substantial degree of confidence, but not perfectly, and with polite differences in opinion in many cases among themselves. And we will probably see some of this in the next days with the presentation that will be made. Prediction in the short to medium term from the next few weeks to perhaps 2-3 years in the future is done with some degree in confidence and sometimes overconfidence, but frequently getting it wrong because of changing market condition, for example, that are usually caused by factor that we cannot predict with certainty, weather, for example, what will be the next growing season condition be? Important policy changes that are beyond the control of the farmer. But still, we are making progress. Let's take, for example, the agriculture market information system that has been put together by the G20 following the 2008 spike, the AMIS system. What it does, it brings the member country together to share their information on prices, on the production, on the policy option that are available in front of multiple variables. Is it working or not? Well, yesterday I was reading a report in the BBC indicating that the current price spike that we have in the maize that has been growing up because of the drought in the Midwest in the US seems to be slightly coming back down. And why? Because these systems are in place. Rather than going on speculation because we don't know, countries have come together, have shared their information, have a better knowledge, and can make better informed decisions. I would argue, and this is thought provocative, that no one, economist or otherwise, really knows with any certainty what will happen in the medium 3 years to long term, 10 to 20 years, let's say, other than in broad strokes, and certainly not in terms of price level or volatility. Now,
one of you will ask me, yes, but Jean, you know, the historical trend's downward. Is it really continuing? Are we still going to be in a cheap food price era? Or is it over? And this, you know, I really don't know. It's very difficult to predict. There seems to be a little of a consensus that is arising now that this era of cheap food price is over because land is less available, because water is less available in many places, because population is still growing and there's still a huge demand on the food, whether it's the staples or others, and that we may very well be in the future having to pursue this journey of higher food price, but certainly also to pursue a journey where there's much more fluctuation. The real challenge that we're facing over here, it's not the price volatility per se, because it's only one equation of the food security, one variable of the food security equation. The real challenge, as the FAO reminded us last week, is that there is one out of eight human beings that goes to bed every night hungry. Hungry, undernourished, meaning that he didn't eat more than 800 calories in his day, on average. So, price volatility is part of the equation that impacts food security. The big picture is that we are nonetheless making progress. If you look at the graph, this top line, in the 90s we had roughly a billion. Now there's a new calculation method that FAO put together. We have reduced by 130 million in the last, you know, 20 years, and we have now 852, you know, million people that are hungry in developing region of the world. If you look at other indicators, like the Millennium Development Goal, one, the MDGs, which are goals that, you know, all country members of the UN have ratified to implement and achieve. The first one is health, reducing by half the prevalence of population that are undernourished. And if you look at the graph, we might be reaching that target. But because of population growth, we still have a huge amount of people that are undernourished. And let's forget, you know, the World Food Summit target of 1996, which was to eradicate undernourishment. So 1 billion to 870, 130 million fewer hungry people today than they were 20 years ago. The Millennium Development Goal, you know, that is still within reach, positive. But there's still one out of eight that don't eat sufficiently in order to, you know, basically survive. Where are they? Well, you know, in this pie chart, you know, you have all the various region. I bring your attention that we have made significant progress in Latin America and Caribbean over the last 20 years. We have made progress in Southeast Asia and Eastern Asia, you know, with reduction, significant reduction. But there's the loser also. And the major places where there is people that are still undernourished and where it's growing is Sub-Saharan Africa. It has moved from 17 to 27% of the population. And Southern Asia, where it has moved from 32.7 to 35%. Now, when you look at it on a map, and this is the map that you will see on the website of the FAO, on the Hunger Portal, that is a beautiful source of information. You see that the darker country are the one that are, you know, having the highest prevalence of undernourished. And what does this lead to? Well, it leads to some of the things that Chandra was mentioning in his introduction. Hungry population are not happy population. Hungry children are affected more than adults. The first 1,000 days are critical. because if you're not fed appropriately, you're at high risk of having cognitive impairment. Undernourishment leads to lower productivity in all sectors of society. Hungry people are more vulnerable to diseases. And at the end of the day, when you are hungry, you are poor, and you have limited resources, the money that you still need to spend on food, which is amazing, don't go to healthcare and don't go to education. Now, let's pause and take stock of where we are and how we link the food security and the price volatility. We see that some progress are made in the big picture. We see that the price are variable, and they have always been since ancient time. You can go back to biblical history and you'll see those price fluctuations. There are some that are predictable with some variability, and they are the ones that are unpredictable. They are affected by a gamut of factors, be it the oil price, be it the distraction towards biofuel, be it the trade policy, be it the stagnation of production, be it the water availability, be it wars that are affecting, you know, the production big time in some places, and the list goes on and on. What we have had a hard time over the years, and still have, and why research is needed, is to predict better what are the intensity of the impact of one variable in the overall equation at a point in time. What we have seen also through this first portion of the presentation is that the trends needs to be interpreted with caution. And you know, that's for students very easy to remember. Sometimes as we are growing up, we tend to forget it. Price volatility is one variable, as I was mentioning. And increase in price matter more for the people that don't have the money. And this is the situation of a lot of smallholder farmers, subsistence farmers. They don't have enough for generating additional income, and sometimes they are not working in any system that will give them the opportunity to bring their product to a market, to a value chain, where they could raise, you know, more resources in order to meet their needs. What can we do to help them to get a better agriculture, to make money out of it, to bring them a better living, one that is sustainable and that lead to cope better with instability, to optimize the uses and the access and bring more to all, to make them food secure? At IDRC, that's the angle that we have been taking through the creation, as Dean Matsumoto was mentioning, of the Canadian International Food Security Research Fund. Let's face it, agriculture accounts for 20 to 40% of GDP in many developing countries. It is estimated, and this is UN number, that economic growth generated in agriculture is on average 4 times more efficient, effective, and benefiting the poorest half of the population than growth generated outside of agriculture. Growth in small agriculture significantly decreases poverty and in most cases also contributes to greater economic quality, and it can also be sustainable. Through the CIFSRF, as we are saying, CIDA and IDRC have rallied to bring their resources together, value of $62 million over a 5-year period, and launch a call mechanism open not only to researchers in university, but also NGOs active in research, and also available to other actors like the private sector. And I will come back to this. We are looking, and we have been looking, at projects that cross the natural science and the social science, that brings actors that do not necessarily speak together all the time, together in order to meet and to face the problem that they have defined and to find a solution to the problem that they have defined that can help their country. And we've done this through innovative partnership. many, you know, question us at IDRC internally and externally, saying, your mandate is to fund research in developing region of the world. And we said, absolutely. But this country and the university system in this country, when it comes to agriculture, is filled with smart people, as smart as the people that were working in developing region of the world. Let's bring them together around common research project. Let's share the pie, and let's bring those best brain in order to find the best solution. And if we find solution, let's try to make sure that it's responding to the need of the people, but it's scaled up in the policy process. And it's leading to an improvement of condition, not only for a small group, but for a scale that is much larger. This has led to sponsoring, since 2010, 19 projects, 20 countries, the map is there, 11 Canadian organizations, 26 organizations in developing region of the world. And just to give you a broad view of what we have been funding through a competitive process, and as Chandra mentioned, you know, we were surprised. We were expecting 20, 30, 40 proposals. The first call, we got 360. The second one that was more targeted, we got 260. And the third one, I think, wasn't the same number. I'm looking at my staff. I think it was 250. And we have funded 19 projects. Highly competitive, high-quality research. It's not because it's done in developing region of the world that we're lowering the bar. No, the bar is high for people there also. So the portfolio looks like things that we're doing is how we can identify and develop improved crops. Things like millet, legumes, indigenous vegetable, root crops, things that are not necessarily well researched. How can we improve management practice, farming system, livestock practice, aquaculture? How we can improve post-harvest technologies, processing, the value chains for vegetable, fruits, nutrition and health. Probably the biggest surprise for us at IDRC and for our colleagues at CEDA. A huge interest in diversification of food. Women and children, food safety, and lastly, an area that we had left behind for many years at IDRC, things that are more biotechs, like vaccine development for things that have been present for years, small pests of ruminants, or I'm going to fail in the pronunciation of pneumonia because the P doesn't need to be pronounced, pneumonia in bovine. So a solid and diverse portfolio of projects from farm to fork, a motto that we're hearing a lot. Pragmatically, I'll give you two examples because time is running. Revalorizing millets in India. Malnutrition affects a lot, you know, Indian people more than anywhere else in the world. It's a broad term, malnutrition, that essentially means that, you know, we are entering good health because of an inadequate or an imbalanced food diet intake. While staple food in India, such as wheat and rice, are subsidized by the Indian government, these crops, like millet, do not always, no, sorry. While, you know, there are subsidies and there is good research investment in India for, you know, staple crops like, you know, wheat and rice, despite this, there is still difficulty in reaching out to some people because of failure of the extension services or because conditions that are not favorable to the growth of these crops. Millet come as a nice way to circumvent this difficulty. It's nutritious, it's high in protein, it's high in fiber, it is used in bread and cookies, it's used in beer also, millet beer. It reduces type 2 diabetes, it's helping to lower cholesterol, it prevents gallstones, but there's a challenge. It's a very hard grain. And when you come to the processing of this hard grain, in post-harvest, you have cultivated it, you are having good yield, you have to beat it up, literally, in order to de-hull it, to take out the envelope. Brown millet that you see is the one that is the least refined. White millet is the one that has the highest value after this laborious process. The price you get for white millet in India is 4 to 6 times higher than the price you would get for the brown variety. It is cultivated on 20% of the land in India. It used to be 33%. It has moved down. And there is an interest in raising it back up. Now, the research project is done by University of Darwin, the M.S. Swaminathan Research Foundation, a local NGO called EXO, don't ask me the acronym, what stands for, I don't know, and by McGill University. I will not get into the details of everything that is done in this project, but simply concentrate on this refinement of an existing technology for de-hulling the grain. Tough word to process. Tough word to use. So right now the technology that is being used with small mills, as you have seen in previous slides, you know, is able to process at a level of 40% the purity of the grain from brown to white. With this new device, which you see is relatively rudimentary, it's a spinning wheel where you are putting the millet directly and it's being thrown on a metal plate and being de-hulled. After a first pass, you get 80% purity. After two passes, you get 90% purity. It's simple. It does not require a lot of expertise and training. And essentially, anyone in the village, men, women, children, with some caution, can use it. It's durable. It has, at least up to now, in places where it was tested, 4 villages in 4 geographic regions of India, that is a huge country, reaching about 1,000 households. It has proven to be having a fairly long life for its use. And a side effect, it has proved to be a bit cleaner than the old process with the mill that was throwing a lot of this hull outside and creating dust. A side effect of this that was not anticipated is that this white millet now is sold by women in some path along the road for pilgrims that are moving to sacred site. They are already in this very early phase of the research making money out of this new process that is being implemented. Now, I mentioned to you that those innovations need to be brought to scale, and it's often the case where there is failure. We are great in generating numbers of innovation, they stay on the shelf. In India, what we have seen up to now, with big surprise, and their government have seen a big interest into this. Last year in their budget, they put $68 million aside. Yes, true, they put only 10% for research on millet, but $68 million aside in order to improve, you know, the production of millet. And with the O, and that's the Planning Commission, anyone at work in India know that the Planning Commission is quite influential. The Planning Commission not only look at this carefully, but they are really eager to bring the research result in the policy process. Second and last example, and that's essentially what I've been mentioning to you, is another one that brings us again in the post-harvest. I could have bring you something more about the, you know, pulse crops, but I like this one. Why do I like this one? It's one that is run by the Tamil Nadu University, an organization in Sri Lanka, as well as University of Guelph in Canada. Fruits, you know, are a commodity or a product that can get great value. But the challenge we have with fruit and vegetable is their life is quite limited once they are taken out of the field. You can spoil fruit and vegetable fairly rapidly. Here, what has taken place is that a team in Guelph some years ago have identified, others have identified before, a substance that the fruits are emitting when they are getting scratched in order to prevent their spoilage. It's called hexanal. And they've been able to produce hexanal through manufacturing. Now, they are using this hexanal product, that is a natural compound, to spray, and they use it to spray peaches and berries in Canada. It has proven to raise the shelf life and makes the food available for a longer period of time at good price. In India, they are checking if this can work in the condition encountered in India with mangoes. And they are spraying, and I won't get into the details of the spraying regime, but just to illustrate with, you know, a picture that works 1,000 words, on the top 4 picture, what you see are these mangoes from left to right that have received different treatment with this hexanal product being sprayed in the field on the mangoes. So the left-hand side, you see there is limited spoilage. There's a little bit more because the treatment was different in the second picture, third picture also, and the fourth one, there was no picture. And this is at room temperature, and this is 14 days after they have been harvested. Room temperature in those regions can be up to 30, 35 degrees. The bottom pictures are mangoes through the same regime, but in a value chain where there is cold facility. 14 days after, look, on the left-hand side, with one treatment, another treatment, and at the end, no treatment. So you see that it seems, in very early days, that this is working, at least 14 days. And there's a lot of other things that needs to be tested. And with these two projects, you know, I don't pay tribute to the old picture. Because many of you will say, yes, but John, you know, this is just a technological fix. And we know that silver bullets don't work. You need to understand the context. You need to understand who is playing a role. What is the power relation? Where is the money coming from? What is the money being used for? Who is in the community benefiting from this? Who is not? Well, these questions are also being looked in these projects. I concentrate on some technological aspect because I think they are easier to illustrate the case when it comes to present this to a general audience, as I was told you were hopefully not too many specialists in the room, which I doubt. Now, how do we wrap this up? Well, you know, there is no simple solution. True, what we have been doing with CEDA and what others have been doing, because we're not alone in this world, we know that it's important to consider the local context. And in agriculture, we are lucky, close to nature. 2 weeks ago, I was with numbers of very high-level people, people with magnificent brain, Nobel Prize, and they asked me to talk about how natural science have influenced development over the last 40 years. And fortunately, they didn't ask me in advance. They asked me, you know, half a day before because someone didn't show up at the meeting. And I was frightened. You know, when Amasya Sen sit next to you, you better say something intelligent. And what I came with says, well, in natural science, and that would apply to agricultural science, we know that nature is complex. And because this complexity, we know that silver bullet don't fix the problem. In agriculture, as in natural science, we know that diversity is important. And it's through diversity, through the diverse research that is being conducted, through the diverse options that is being that are being looked at, that we can find solution that can provide more resilience to these farmers that are facing the shocks that are created by condition outside of their livelihood. In agriculture as a natural science, we know also that scale is important. I gave you a picture of very macro level early in my talk. I'm bringing you down to the field with the illustrative cases. At IDRC, for some 20 years, we have worked on community-based natural resource management. We started that about 3 years ago. Why? Because after 20 years, we were seeing great stories. We could never scale them up. Does it mean that it was wrong? No. It was the type of research that served a need and a purpose at a very localized level. It's still important, but we decided to move on because others are doing it better than our recipient are doing it now, and some others will do it better. When we are talking of scale in agriculture, the ultimate goal is always to go from the farm to dozens of farms, to hundreds of peoples, 100,000 and million. And this has proven a challenge to be done. Fortunately, some are looking at, and I will come back to this. My fourth point about agriculture and nature, after, you know, the complexity, the diversity, and the scale, it's time. Patience is important. And for us, as donor, it has to register somewhere. We cannot get result in 6 months when it comes to agriculture. Some might be generated. Most of the time, it takes more time. And finally, a bit of humility, I think, is necessary. So, you know, research is essential because research is there to answer the question where we don't have answer. Question that you may have as a researcher, that you may have translated from the population that are living in harsh condition. And through the research process, we hope that we can find sustainable way of bringing food to the people, increasing their food security, considering everyone in the community, in the region, and in the countries, and hopefully globally. Closing remark, what's the future? I am optimistic by nature, but I'm not a fool. Let's say that I'm reasonably optimistic. We have seen some progress, insufficient. We have seen money starting to flow back into agricultural research. The CGIAR that I was mentioning earlier, Consultative Group in International Agricultural Research, raises budget, I think, this year to 700 million to, I think, 400 million a few years ago. Donors are coordinating themselves better. IDRC CETA is an illustration. Others have done the same. The Syngenta Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, other actors, the EU, the US government, and the band goes on. And when I mentioned the private sector earlier, I want to come back to it because what is preventing me from sleeping at night with all these development and all this optimism is that we miss opportunity to raise those innovation at a scale that really make a difference and bring down this curve from 850 down to zero. And I hardly see any reason why we should not engage more firmly with the private sector. We have done so recently with the Syngenta Foundation of Sustainable Development. It's very early days. We are looking forward to more on this front. We are looking also forward to more resources, as the Prime Minister of Canada announced last October, a second phase of this program that we will roll out in the near future. And with this, we can only hope that today and tomorrow, people in developing region of the world, in as well as here, because remember, there's still 16 million people in developed countries that are undernourished, can benefit from the output of research and live a better livelihood. Thank you for your attention.
Merci beaucoup, Jean. pour votre présentation. Jean has illustrated quite well the complexities of the problem of price volatility and food security. You might have fooled us in your presentation. I thought you were an expert there on everything in such a great way in which you have made this subject for us. Mesdames et Messieurs, nous avons quelques minutes, environ 15 minutes, pour les questions de Monsieur Jean Labelle. So we have some time for one or two questions. I also want to acknowledge at the back of the room, Marco Ferroni from the Cinzenta Foundation. Marco, could you stand, please? The Cinzenta Foundation is a very strong supporter of our conferences, has been since the start. We're grateful that Marco is here, and I know that Marco and Jean work quite extensively. So, ladies and gentlemen, the floor is open for a few questions, please. Yeah, so, Mike, yes, please use the microphones.
Hello, Mike. Not quite what I meant to do, but there we are. My name's Felix von Geyer. I'm actually a freelance sustainable development journalist. I'm trying to think where to start. Achim Steiner, talking in February, he was saying that like about a quarter of agricultural land has lost its productivity. You've got the soil erosion on top, and many of the factors of the doom and gloom people, perhaps like Lester Pearson at the Earth Policy Institute, will say, you know, we're really like one disaster away from a major kind of food crisis. And you can look at the Russian forest fires a couple of years ago that impacted on wheat prices in Egypt, that impacted on Mubarak's departure. We look at what's happened in Canada and the US this summer. But what's your message? Because you're saying that really, we can do an awful lot. We've got to do an awful lot of research. You've got to be kind of micro-targeting our research rather than coming up with like a macro gloom and doom kind of prediction. But what's your message really for policymakers to actually target that kind of research, to actually come up with a multitude of silver bullets where it counts?
Well, it's a good question. Now, what I've presented to you is not everything that is getting done. Let me make this clear. There is research that is needed at the macro level and that is being conducted at the macro level, if I understood well your question. And that's the case, you know, for the International Food Policy Research Institute, and I guess some of their members of this organization are present over here. Now, the main point of your question, if I get it right, is, you know, how do you sell this to policy actors? It's an excellent question. If I had the formula, you know, I would not be here. You know, I would be somewhere else, probably under the sun. What we have seen working over the years is that policy is not made in a vacuum. You need to understand the policy landscape of where you are operating. You need to be able, as a researcher or someone that wants to change the situation, to understand through which window or which door, and when is it open that you can enter. Then, I think you need to have good communication skill to make, sorry to use the term, a sales pitch that counts. You know? And often, it's not necessarily only economical. It's about, you know, a crucial problem that is faced that hasn't found a resolution and where you are bringing a solution. I'll give you an example with water management. In Bolivia, since the colonial years of the beginning of the 20th century, it was impossible to get a reform of the water code, the water law. I think there was 32 attempts, and all failed in Parliament. Up to the moment where a young researcher, an engineer, in fact, that is now the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Bolivia, that we provided small funding, but not only us, many others, and decided to look at the water allocation technique, if you want, that the communities were using in the Andes, in Bolivia, and to see, you know, if this was a fair system. He mapped this, he modeled this, and then he used the data that were generated in the capital by the technocrat on science base only, and merged them together. By doing this, he opened a space of dialogue with the policy actors, and they brought their science that they had developed in the technocratic model with the knowledge that was generated through different methods with local community. And what they discovered? The model that they had built was more performing than the model that was used previously. And that has led to more water for everyone, rather than more water for some and no water for others. And this has been brought to the policy process, and the water law was reformed in 2003, if I'm right, for the first time after 32 failed attempts. Illustration. Right message, knowing your policy, and not only one individual made a difference, multiple research stream came together to make a vibrant case for a better system.
Thank you. There are two sets of microphones on either side, so feel free to use both microphones. Yes,
thank you. Thank you very much for the very informative and motivating talk. I am very happy to see that there is more than one optimist in the room. The numbers that you mentioned from the last FAO report are certainly, let me call it relatively good news after a couple of years of seeing the numbers going up and a very difficult situation. When we talk about food insecurity, we focus a lot on the issues of availability and the undernourishment numbers reported by FAO. But certainly, as you mentioned, food insecurity and food security taps into many different components. And one of those refers to the quality of the foods that people are consuming. And more we see that food insecure population groups in Latin America, Northern Africa, and certainly in certain Asian regions do consume enough energy to survive from one day to the other, but the quality of the foods they are consuming are making them more vulnerable to all the problems. And we have been talking about the double burn of undernourishment and obesity under the same roof, basically, for a couple of years already. So I would like to hear your comment on that specific aspect, which makes this problem certainly more complex. Thank you.
Well, first of all, congratulations on your nomination at the Institute. We will interact, I'm sure, a lot in the future. Secondly, on the specific of, you know, the quality of the diet. This is a big problem, and, you know, two years ago, I was working with Rachel Nugent and the Chicago Council of Global Affairs on, you know, trying to see the connection between agriculture, nutrition, and health. And there's a big connection there. The challenge that we have is that many people think that obesity is a problem in the U.S., in Canada, and in Europe. There's a lot of education that we need to do. Because if you look at obesity, and you know, don't quote me on this, but I think the worst number are currently in Mexico. What we are seeing developing is, I think, the worst of two worlds. In the lowest income country that are still struggling with the diseases of developing region, malaria, undernutrition, there's also, in some of these countries, population that is getting better, improving its income, and shifting its diet, and falling into obesity. And with obesity comes, you know, other type of problem, whether it's heart diseases, whether it's, you know, other type of diseases. So I'm saying it's the worst of two worlds. Because if you're in government, and you have limited resources to allocate to your health budget, where do you put the money? Do you put it with the problems that have been seen for many, many, many years that are still unresolved? Or do you invest it on the emerging problems that are coming up? And that's a challenge. And you know, the question is often not either or, is that you have to do both, but you do less. So that's something that is on the rise. You know very well that you're hearing more about this. There's a number of research in the portfolio I described that touches on nutrition that are looking at some of these components. But in terms of having an answer to the problem, as for you, I don't.
I'm Dr. Aril Joshi from the Indian Himalayas. And I thank you. I thanks IDRC. I am one of the partner of MSSRF Tharavar. I am the one from the Himalayas. And I just want to thank you for helping our community to gain the benefits out of the research done by the MSSRF and the Tharavar. An answer to Mr. Generalist's question also, because after this intervention only, the state government has adopted the whole process where the shrines being motivated to buy the millets offering made by the villagers. I'm requesting something other than that to the IDRC. Well, the agriculture in Himalayas and in the other parts of the country, rural part particularly, is forest inclusive. It cannot be taken as an independent agriculture as such. It's an animal husbandry, forest inclusive, and many, many other factors that forms an agriculture in our country. Therefore, it is very, very important whenever we think of an agriculture, because 50% of total food production come from the marginal small farmers. They'll habit in the rural areas where the forests are. Therefore, any mechanism, there must be a mechanism whenever we do any intervention in agriculture, it must be integrated, number one. And the second important is, well, if a problem identified by institute, we respect that. But there must be a process. The problem be identified by the community and ultimately the research institute adopt it as a research. Because that mechanism, unfortunately, there is a large gap. What our problems are, they should match to the research done by the community and at the institute. That is what I have been wondering. For example, in my place, whatever we produce, more than 50% is eaten away by the wild animals. So we were wondering that should we have a cropping pattern which the wild animal cannot eat away. And therefore, the spices, the tuberous crops came in the picture, and that was developed by the community as such. And here need the intervention of the institute, the kind of varieties, and many, many value-added chains and so on. My request is that IDRC definitely doing wonderful work, and I am the one example here. And therefore, we really need a mechanism within the IDRC too to find out integrated, inclusive, and also the priorities where the institute should work. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The only thing I can tell you is that, you know, in French we say usurpateur. How do we say this in English? Usurper. Yeah, I'm the usurper of the work that you and your colleagues and community are doing. IDRC is only good to provide the funding, help you to build the platform, but you are the one being here and the next day that will deliver the keynotes on your work. And that's what's important, because it's much more powerful for the people in your country to hear you than to hear me. And that's what we have been doing for more than 40 years now at IDRC. So thank you very much for your kind words.
Thank you, Bishop. Go to the other side of the room, please, sir.
Thank you. So my name is Charles Nkou. I work for the Inter-American Institute for Cooperation on Agriculture, coming from Ottawa.
Can you speak a bit louder? Yes.
Louder? Okay. So Charles Nkou from the Inter-American Institute for Cooperation on Agriculture. And if you allow me, I'm going to ask my question in French. But you are welcome to translate. Oui. Donc, j'ai apprécié dans votre présentation le rapport que vous faisiez avec l'équation et le fait en fait que dans l'équation la volatilité des prix était une des variables. Personnellement, je suis agronome, j'ai le sentiment en fait que face à cette complexité en fait du défi, mon approche scientifique consisterait à simplifier l'équation. En l'occurrence, éliminer la variable volatilité des prix de l'équation. Peut-être plus facile à dire qu'à faire, mais j'ai participé il y a quelques semaines au sommet des agronomes à Québec. J'ai pu constater en fait une approche qui avait été suggérée de la part d'un des speakers, selon laquelle il s'agirait en fait de retirer du du marché régulier un certain nombre de commodités. Et pour cela, en fait, je pense que ça, c'est quelque chose qui est à adresser au niveau des politiques. Donc, contrairement, en fait, à d'autres variables, en fait, dans l'équation, la volatilité des prix, pour moi, me paraît être gérable d'un point de vue politique. Je ne sais pas quelle est, de votre point de vue, la faisabilité de ce genre de choses et la... Comment on peut dire ça ? Côté réaliste, en fait, de l'approche.
Vous me posez une question où je pourrais devenir riche si j'avais la réponse, probablement. Mais écoutez, premièrement, je reviens à mon point plus tôt. Je ne suis pas l'expert dans le domaine. Et quand vient le temps de parler de volatilité des prix, vous savez très bien qu'on ouvre la porte sur la spéculation. Et la spéculation ouvre la porte sur les stocks. Et ouvrir la porte sur les stocks ouvre la porte sur la question des barrières tarifaires au niveau des pays, vise des questions d'autonomie au niveau des pays, de souveraineté, et je ne suis pas l'expert. Alors, je ne peux pas vous répondre une réponse parfaite et sensée. Ce que je peux vous dire, c'est si vous êtes quelqu'un qui travaille sur la question, je serais très intéressé d'en apprendre plus. Merci.
Merci beaucoup. OK, mesdames et messieurs, la dernière question, s'il vous plaît.
Yes, Dan Meikleham, chairman of Urban Barnes. I listened with some intensity to the prices, and I've got some questions. Was the prices you quoted in your slide, was that the average global prices, or was it the prices of the countries that doesn't have food security? The prices, of course, would be driven by both the supply and the price in the marketplace. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about what you think that the land purchase deals going on in countries like Africa would have in future prices of food for those people. And the second point is, if the people that are currently starving in countries and continents like Africa, if those people didn't die, I wonder what the prices would have, or what that effect would have on the price of food for the security of the surviving people into the future.
Okay. Yeah, very good question. Sorry, thanks, Chandra. Well, on your first question, if I get it right, my apologies if I'm wrong, you know, we can pursue conversation later. Essentially, the price that I've presented are coming from multiple sources. The FAO Food Index is a composite index that is integrating the price of various, as I mentioned, commodities, and they are averaging by country over a period of time. The methodology is available. You can look at it. The rice price index that was there is the rice price index on the market, and I don't recall exactly the one, but it reflects the world, you know, price that you're going to pay in most places at a point in time for the commodity. Now, your question, how does this in fact impact rural farmer? It may not impact him. I don't see you. Where are you? There. Okay. It may not impact a rural farmer, and I'm going to tell you why. A rural farmer may be self-sufficient with a product that he's growing in his field, and it might not be rice, and it might not be wheat, and it might not be maize. And he's going to cope with a shock, okay? He's going to stockpile a little bit of grain for the next tough time in order to feed himself, or he's going to sell on the local market this food. In the best case, in the worst case, there's no market, he doesn't have the right technology to grow his food, and you know, he's stuck with growing not enough food, not making money out of it. So it can be, you know, no effect, but still he's going to be suffering. In urban settlement, that's far different. because in urban setting, you know, people apart from, you know, the urban agriculture, apart from the urban agriculture, which is a marginal phenomenon, although it's present, it's marginal vis-à-vis the rest of the population, the access to the food is through either the supermarket or the market. And if the foods are traded on global commodity, they're going to be facing this price spike. And that's what we have seen, you know, in many places in the last 6 years, since 2007. Now, what is the end point of the answer to your question over here? Let me try to work out my brain a little bit quicker. Okay, the rural, the urban, and what is the impact on the urban? Well, the urban, here again, it's the poor that's going to suffer the most, and that's going to go undernourished, or at risk. Now, the effects might be dramatic, because, you know, you can cope with those spikes for one time, maybe, but when they are repeated or they are coming in waves that are very close to one to each other, you are, you know, essentially reducing the availability of limited resource that you have to buy food. And then you are starving, and sometimes you're unable to get out of the poverty. The good side, because I'm optimistic by nature, if rural people grow things locally that are not traded at the global market, but are becoming important, like millet, that get into the distribution system of the country, there might be a spillover effect where this commodity becomes available at the larger scale and can bring increased resources.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to have to bring this to an end because Dr. LaBelle has another event that he has to participate in at 7:15, and we're not giving him very much time to get there. But I want to thank you all very much again for being here. I invite you to participate in the conference over the next 2 days. We have a very exciting program with some very renowned speakers. We start off tomorrow at 8:30 with a presentation by Dr. Prabhu Pingali from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Always terrific to listen to Dr. Pingali and Prabhu as we know him, terrific person, and we invite you to the residence for the presentations. Once again, let me also thank our speakers this evening. Thank you very much, Jean.
Thank you to you.
And thank you as well, Jean, for the support from IDRC. You've always been with us as a financial supporter of our conferences as well, and we very much appreciate that. So thank you. Bonsoir tout le monde. Merci.
Bonsoir, merci.
Thank you. Excellent.
Was it?
Yeah. I mean, you captured it. I was right on the next topic.